Welcome to Indie Radio Garden, this week's highlights from community radio in the Philadelphia region.
This program brings ordinary citizens to the air to discuss issues related to health, race, safety, workers' rights, and the will to survive in pandemic times.
This week we have audios from WGGT LP 92.9 G-Town Radio. Our first show is called Info Hub, with host Malika Froyan and guest Dr. Florencia Greer-Poli on the topic of COVID-19 vaccination.
Greetings, everyone. Welcome to the Germantown Info Hub Radio Hour. My name is Malika Fruin, and I'm the community organizer here. Dr. Florencia Greer-Poli is a doctor of obstetrics and gynecology at Penn Medicine and is joining us today to talk about COVID-19 and vaccinations. Hello, Dr. Poli. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Doctor, you are actively delivering babies and doing surgeries, but you've also been spreading the word about COVID-19 updates and vaccination facts, especially for the Black and Brown community. Why is this important to you?
Well, the last 10 months have been pretty challenging. I have been a frontline worker because, as I like to say, babies don't care that there's a pandemic. They're still coming. So we have been in the hospital delivering care to patients who have had COVID, patients who've recovered from COVID. And I've seen, you know, family, friends, colleagues, really affected by COVID-19.
And doctor, what are some common misconceptions about the COVID-19 vaccine?
So the most common misperception is that the COVID-19 vaccine actually contains coronavirus. So it is a vaccine that actually has a live virus in it. And that was incredibly important for me at the time that I decided to take the vaccine, because I didn't want to take a vaccine that had a little bit of coronavirus in it. So it is an mRNA vaccine, which is essentially like a blueprint that tells your body how to make the immune response against coronavirus, but it does not actually contain coronavirus in it. There's a number of other misconceptions as well, including some of the side effects, like it causes Bell's palsy, or that it has a microchip in it, or that it can affect sterilization. There's a number of things that just biologically don't make sense from an mRNA vaccine.
So none of those are true.
None of those are true. Those are all fictional.
So I know me personally and people I know are really nervous because the vaccine came out so quickly. What are some things that you need to say to us that we're nervous because we just don't know how much research was done?
So first off, I would tell you that I am somebody who normally is not an early adopter. I'm not somebody who signs up to do things right away. And I, in order to feel comfortable taking the vaccine, had to do my own research about what types of trials were done, what did the EUA or getting this under an emergency use authorization, what exactly did that mean? So I was happy to learn that there were 30,000 participants in both trials, in the Pfizer and in the Moderna trials, and that Black and Hispanic people actually made up a decent number of people who were included in those. I also watched one of the FDA webinars, and I learned that this was a process where, yes, we were able to speed it up, but we did not cut corners, which is a difference, right? There's a lot of bureaucracy and red tape in the government that sometimes does make things take a little bit longer than they actually need to. And instead, when you have a pandemic that's of global proportions, you can literally say, we want all hands on deck. We want all scientists focused on this one specific outcome, and how can we make this better? Also, I learned that when you're studying how to make a vaccine, if the actual infection is more common, which we know coronavirus is, that it's actually easier to study it in a patient population. And finally, I learned that the actual mRNA vaccine technology had been studied at Penn Medicine for over a decade. And so all of those things made me feel better. I still had to realize, though, that the risk and benefit assessment that I'm making was not taking the vaccine versus not taking the vaccine. The risk assessment, as one of my colleagues, Dr. Megan Lenfall, said, is the risk assessment is taking the COVID-19 vaccine versus getting COVID, because that's really where we are right now. We have, you know, over 450,000 people who have died. We're talking about a 9/11 a day in terms of the death toll. And the idea of what's at stock if we wait, I will tell you, you know, look at the last 10 months. That's to me is what's worrisome in the next few months. How many more thousands of people will die? And that's the risk assessment that I had to make.
Yes, I understand. That's now I see, and that's totally right. Dr. Polite, we focus on getting information to Germantown and the surrounding Northwest neighborhoods. If people are trying to get the vaccine, how do they do it?
So a great question, because right now we have two unique problems. We have one problem with the Black and Brown community, which is some mistrust of the medical profession, which, just to be clear, the medical profession has earned, right? Over 400 years of us not actually treating the Black and Brown communities well, what us watching, you know, higher death rates from most cancers, people actually having problems actually getting in to see care. So we have access to general medical care, leading to a mistrust of the medical community, leading to mistrust of the vaccine. That's my job, to actually help educate our community and to say, here's where you can find out this information. The second problem we have is actually access with the vaccine rollout. So you have the community, Germantown, Mount Airy. You have my mom, who lives in Mount Airy, 73 years old, who's like, I want to get vaccinated, and couldn't actually find a place to get vaccinated, right? So then we have this second issue of people who are like, sign me up. I'm going to stand in line for 2 or 3 hours. We have, you know, the city giving this contract to vaccine distribution to folks who weren't qualified to do that. So we have a number of sites that are opening even in the last week. Clearly, you have the Black Doctors Consortium, who's been around since the beginning of this pandemic doing testing, that's actually doing a number of vaccines a day. And they've increased the number of vaccines that they've been able to do a day. Penn Medicine has started already to vaccinate patients who are in the 1B category. And you can actually sign up, like, through a portal. You can call, you can send the message to your doctor and they send you an invitation. We also have a number of vaccine sites that are being set up in the communities, like actually where people are, which is what makes sense. But that really is the second part of this pandemic problem.
Is there a way that people can sign up without a computer?
I'm not actually sure about that, to be perfectly honest. I don't know of any of the sites that I just spoke of. I'm sure that some of the Black churches who are getting on board with being vaccination sites will have somewhere you can call. But as of this point, I have to be honest, I don't know of any.
Okay. So definitely something to look into. Mm-hmm. Are there any other important notes you want people to know about the vaccine or COVID-19 today?
Even once you get vaccinated, it's going to take a while for us to get this concept of herd immunity. So that's the place where we've already gotten with smallpox and other big things, where the vast majority of the community is vaccinated to the point that if you had an outbreak, it's really small and not something of this global pandemic proportion. So even after people get vaccinated, they have to wear a mask. We have to wear a mask. We have to wear a mask. We have to wear a mask. Like, we're not going to get to herd immunity for likely over a year. I mean, it's literally going to take that long for the community to get vaccinated and for us to be able to see the decline that we need to see. So masking and social distancing is super important. And quite frankly, what we see is that people are just getting fatigued. They're tired of it, right? It's like, oh, it's 10 months. At this point, I want to go to a party. I want to go out to eat. I want to, you know, I want to have a Super Bowl event. And we can't succumb to the idea of, I'm just over it. The second thing I would say is, there's the number of folks that I've met in our community who are just saying, nope, I'm passing on the vaccine. Like, that to me is really short-sighted. Do your homework. Reach out to professionals who you care, who you trust. Reach out to, you know, the CDC, the FDA. Like, actually do your homework before you just dismiss this one medical technology that, quite frankly, is revolutionary and is the only way that I see out of where we are now. And mind you, I'm a Philly girl. I'm a Mount Airy, Germantown girl. This is where I grew up. I love taking care of patients from here. I want our community to be back to where we were. And this is what I see as the only hopeful chance we have of getting back to where we were.
Is there some place folks can go to learn more about getting the vaccine and current updates on COVID-19?
Yeah, so Penn has a website where they actually keep up with, like, literally all the new updates that are coming up. It's under pennmedicine.com, and then you would find the coronavirus, and they literally update it with CDC updates as well. And hopefully the CDC will also be putting out some of the information from those of us who were vaccinated early. So my first vaccine was December 16th, and my second was January 6th, the day of the insurrection. And I was part of the CDC V-Safe program, or vaccine safety program, where I was texted every day after I got the vaccine to talk about my symptoms. And so the hope is that this information will also be made available to the public, so that as we vaccinate hundreds of thousands of people, we can, again, reassure the public about what these symptoms look like. In general, the symptoms are very mild and certainly nothing compared to getting COVID itself.
This has been so important and just so helpful. Thank you so much for joining us today, Dr. Polite.
From WJYN-LP 98.5 Uptown Entertainment and Development, we next have the Talk to Reeves show, hosted by E. Marie Lambert, where there is a testimony of a six-year-old girl on a town hall social justice meeting.
Thanks for listening. You're on the air with 98.5 FM, WJYN Uptown Radio.
Hi, my name is E. Marie Lambert. You're listening to the Talk to Reeves show, Town Hall on Social Justice. Listen to the voices of the community from ages 7 and up. I ask people to use their voices to share their opinions, experiences, and ideas towards solutions of social justice.
Hi, my name is Leah, and I'm 6 years old, and I want to just tell you guys about what's going around in the world and how I'm feeling about that. So I feel pretty mad because the people around us shouldn't be treating us like that. And if we could try to be nice to them, they might be nice to us. And I will march with the other people because I want all this stuff to stop. And I'm mad because this even started in the first place. So I just wanted to say, I just don't like this. So we have to try to be nice to them. They might be nice to us. Everybody who can hear this, march out with them and love each other. Love everybody, even the ones who be mean to you. And pray for them. And also, you can pray for them that other people would be nice to the other people that you're praying for, too. So, just showing you my feelings. Bye!
Hi, you're listening to the Talk to Reeves show, Town Hall on Social Justice.
From the WPEB New Community Journalist Project, we have host Lone Nguyen interviewing Juvenile Food Justice Coordinator Min Chon about racial violence against the Asian population amid the pandemic.
Min, I am currently going to college studying culinary arts and also working with this Vietnamese nonprofit organizations in South Philly called Bitly. I live in Center City, specifically Chinatown area.
Have you always lived in predominantly Asian community?
No, used to live in East Norriton, and that area is having more white, and then to Asian is just like 10 out of 1,000.
So how are you feeling being amongst a fellow majority in Chinatown?
For me, I don't have that connection with Chinatown, even though I lived there like for like years now. I think, yeah, it's part of my like identity as like in Vietnamese and Chinese persons, and trying to like find out like, you know, oh, which community is like better for me, because I have like the good from like both sides. And it just happened that I work with the Vietnamese organizations, and I'm just leaning toward more like the Vietnamese community in South Philly.
So you're saying that you share identity, or you identify with both the Chinese and Vietnamese community, but yes, for you, they're very different.
Yes.
How are they different?
In Chinatown, it's like the most that you see is like businesses, like restaurants and like gift shop. For me, with my experience, I don't feel like community is there like that. Just because everyone have to work. The nature of like Chinatown work is like you work a lot, like 12 to 14 hours per day. And then you're lucky if you have like one day off. Compared to like, you know, the Vietnamese community in South Philly, I think they're more like, you know, separate. Like folks still work and stuff. You know, folks still like try to gather and then folks like actually know each other.
Yeah, I'm curious, what do you think, given like your shared identity with both groups, what do you think about what's going on in America right now with the recent anti-Asian violence? Is there anything about it that's troubling you?
Yeah, I think the most troubling me is the way that Asian American like speak up to the violence, which is great, right? But at the same time, when they do that, they are criminalizing like Black communities.
Why is that?
Just because the way that I see that my friends, a lot of my friends, like posting things on Instagram pages talking about like, oh, this is violent, this is like an incident. Like, and most of those videos and graphics showing Black individuals that committed crimes, when it happened to be like on social media like that, everyone just grouped Black community as like one. Yeah, just because action of a few Black folks that Asian community like grouped together. And then that actually spread more fear to like our communities, because in Philadelphia, also the majority of folks that live here is also Black folks. Keeping that fear is not solving that much thing. And also posting violent videos toward Asians also can be like traumatizing our communities. For me, I'm just like, I understand, you know, what is going on and why you keep posting all this violence that actually not solving anything.
So are you saying that it concerns you more about Asians speaking up and showing Black people doing the violence against Asians, that concerns you more than the violence itself?
Yes.
Why is that?
Because Black community in the U.S. settings been criminalized and have put in prison for like, have, you know, so long. And doing this is not actually helping the Black community out at all, but actually put them more in danger. And then I think another piece I want to speak on is like the relationship with Chinese community, with police. We have like the privilege of, you know, not getting like not getting stopped on the street by the cops like that. And, you know, also like stuff in first. Actually, Chinatown is like have a lot of cops. We have a headquarters within our area, ICE detention center. When folks being aware that Asians are, you know, getting attacked, and then that relationship with the police also making more Black folks like jeopardize their life.
Yeah, you said that it's not helpful the way some Asians are bringing up or speaking up. From your experience, what could be more helpful ways to advocate for our community as Asian Americans who are experiencing violence because of their race during a time when there's a lot of other groups also experiencing unique violence because of their race?
One thing I learned from my job is seeing how violence play out and systematically, given that yes, violence happened interpersonally, but then in like in institutional level, it's like much larger, right? With how the past president was like calling coronavirus like Kung Flu, all that, that's like the cause of like, you know, the actual violence. At least that's like what I feel like. And yeah, and people not really holding, you know, the institutions that saying that accountable. Asian violence also have been like happening for like years. It's just not happening in coronavirus. There are like community organizations that are fighting for like a lot of issues like deportations, food apartheid, housing for like all folks. Like those are violence, right? Not having funding in school that student can thrive, that is violence. You know, having like more cops than actually programs to actually help community, that is violence, right? And I feel like, you know, we folks should like slow down and like look at like the larger way to, you know, hold institutions accountable instead of just like, you know, targeting. Yeah, that's the thing that annoys me. Like when folks like voice back their concern, they don't actually like trying to like figure out like solutions like that, but more like, oh, let's just strap up, have guns and have weapons. And that actually, you know, just putting everyone in fear. What are some ways is that folks can join like community organizations, because a lot of the community organizations actually do like political educations that like pushes folks to like analyze, you know, the settings, and also, you know, just work on like the issues that already happening right now.
Next, we have an interview with Lois Volta, where she interviews three adolescent women, Madeline, Jane, and Penelope, about normalizing menstrual cycles and managing information in society.
How normal do you think it is to talk about periods?
Normal for this family, but not normal for like other families, I don't think.
Why?
I don't know, like in school it's awkward to talk about because like there's like a whole bunch of people watching your reaction. But it's like in like here it's like really normal.
I think it's normal to talk about periods. I don't think other people feel the same way, but I will gladly talk period talk with anyone who's willing any day.
Why is it not normal? Like, what's so uncomfortable about it, and why do you think it's so uncomfortable?
I don't know. People just, like, think of it as uncomfortable, I'm guessing, because it's, like, bodily fluids. Like, you don't just, like, run around yelling, oh, my gosh, did you know poop looks like this when I poop it?
You think that people will talk about pee and talk about poop, but they don't want to talk about periods?
It's just, like, pee and poop, since it's a universal thing, it's more jokey, but, like, I feel because periods are, like, only one gender, it's, like, it's more awkward for some reason. I feel like, stuff that is, like, that everybody has is more, it tends to be some stuff that's more joked about.
How about you, Jane? Why do you think that people don't like to talk about periods?
Because your body is your personal thing. So if someone doesn't feel comfortable sharing about their body or their period, they don't have to be forced to, or they don't need to.
Why do you think it's not normal to talk about periods in public?
Well, I suppose periods have always been kind of like associated with, it's shameful that you have your period and it should be hidden just because, like, I don't know, it's a woman's stuff and men don't really need to know about woman's stuff. It's kind of rooted in that. So I suppose we just feel self-conscious about, just kind of rooted in that shamefulness idea.
I feel like our culture stigmatizes periods as something that's dirty and gross and disgusting.
Even in, like, the early days, women were considered lesser beings and they were meant to bear children, and having your period is just kind of like part of that childbearing process, is in which something that is women's business, it's their thing, and men didn't have to worry about it because they didn't get it. And so I suppose in, like, those, like, times that they would just want to keep it secret because they felt ashamed or something because they thought that they were lesser.
Do you wish that periods and menstrual cycles were just normalized in our culture, that boys could talk about them without feeling awkward, that girls could talk about them without feeling awkward? Like, it was just normal. It's just part of life, just like peeing and pooping.
Well, yeah, I really would wish that, because then people, you could walk around and girls don't have to worry about if they have a stain on their back of their butts, because it's normal.
Yeah, because that stuff happens all the time.
You don't have to be self-conscious about it anymore.
I feel like that would happen if boys had it too.
I think it's a personal thing, and if you had a poop stain on your butt, you would still be embarrassed, even if people could have poop stains on their butts all the time.
Good point. I mean, you don't want to walk around with poop stains on your butt. Like, nobody really wants to poop their pants. What would it take for periods to be normalized?
Well, for one, it would take a lot. Men, it's hard for them to normalize it because they don't experience it. They don't experience the cramps, the uncomfortableness of pads, the walking around being self-conscious. It's hard for them to experience that because they don't have anything remotely similar. So it would take a lot of empathy to normalize it, in my opinion.
So empathy that needs to come from men to normalize it.
Yes.
There are more genders than man and woman.
That's true. So acknowledging that gender's a spectrum and being empathetic to all types of bodies.
Yeah.
What about learning at a younger age that it's totally normal? And this is what I mean by that. You guys are in a very period-friendly household, right? We can talk about periods like it's whatever. What do you think it would take for every household to be like that?
It to be full of women like our house.
I'm thinking about the bigger picture of women being viewed as yucky or dirty, and then women feeling icky and yucky and shameful about their periods. I'm wondering what things that people, normal people, just like me and you and our uncles and brothers and our friends that are guys, like, what things can they do to help this problem that we have, that it's shameful and that it's yucky? Because it's not. It's just part of our bodies.
Well, they could always just, like, when men always, even on not periods, can just keep supporting and trying to understand what we're going through and being there when we need it, with a hot pad or a tampon, and that's about as close as they can come to understand, like, having empathizing. I hope that one day every man and woman will carry an extra pad around with them just in case.
That's a great idea.
There are more genders than just men and women.
Everyone of all genders will carry a pad around with them just in case.
Just in case. I like that.
Almost no matter what, anyone who already has their period will almost definitely support you throughout it. If it's, whether it be a teacher or a parent or a friend, they all know what you're going through and they will help.
That is so true. And that is an amazing bond that women have that men don't have. The shedding of blood is a beautiful way to bond in a very peaceful way that's non-violent.
Chunky.
Oh my goodness.
We ended with a funny interview in a kindergarten classroom with a teacher and her kindergarten students. Host Rob Grace gives us a wonder about a common suspect in the classroom who is the true scapegoat of the room.
Project Play is a preschool at the border of Philadelphia and Elkins Park. It's a small school with a big mission: to guide kids in how to play, how to relate to each other, how to take responsibility for their actions. It's that last part that has been under threat lately from an outside source.
White Spider-Man.
Project Play founder Karen Shayat explained the function of White Spider-Man in the classroom culture.
White Spider-Man is a scapegoat for things that go wrong, things that maybe aren't the best choices.
For example,
it can be somebody got water spilled on them by somebody else. White Spider-Man did.
Larry and Casey are two friends who go to Project Play.
I'm 4 and a half, he's 4.
Casey described her appearance.
Well, she's white and she looks like a spider and she has a pet white spider.
And when I asked about her origins, the answer was similarly vague.
She just appears up.
Larry took note of a common White Spider-Man theme.
When we were eating lunch, White Spider-Man ate all our lunch.
And again.
And sometimes she steals all the food.
I asked Karen if the kids use White Spider-Man to correct themselves, as an acknowledgement that they've done something they're not proud of.
No.
They use it's a White scapegoat. Spider-Man as a freedom.
Yes.
To test the limits.
Casey backed up his teacher.
Have you ever done something bad and then wanted to blame it on White Spider-Man?
Well, mostly no.
But even White Spider-Man has her limits.
White Spider-Man just made me do that. He pushed it on me.
There have been times where things have happened where they'll blame White Spider-Man and it's like, no, you did it.
Right.
So there is a line.
Mm-hmm.
I can't really describe what it is or when I use that line, but I have used it.
Karen understands that White Spider-Man represents a typical and healthy expression of kids actively engaged with navigating their social order. It can be a tougher sell at home.
Parents didn't get it, really, that it's really okay. It's just an alter ego. I mean, this they've created to take the fall for them. So they, you know, they know deep down inside that they've created it. But things change and evolve, and in the kid's head, reality is blurred.
Even within the Project Play community, the buy-in isn't universal. Here's Amelia and Clara.
The people that don't believe in hope, she doesn't come to the people that don't believe in her past. I don't believe in her at all.
Why does Project Play permit some kids to lean on an alter ego? Karen explained that quite simply, because it's the kid's own creation, their own mechanism to navigate their relationships.
It's freeing for them. They haven't, nobody shut it down. Nobody told them this is ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
Not the peers, not the teachers.
From Project Play, I'm Rob Grace.
Nobody's fumbled, man. Nobody's fumbled, man.
White Spider-Man.
Thank you for listening to Indie Radio Garden. I am your host, Gabriella Daza. Indie Radio Garden is a Prometheus Radio Project production. Remember to tune into us next week.